The topic of the shiur tonight is Chazal and science, and when the two diverge. The first question to ask is, I think it's Torah and science. The first question to ask is, what does science mean? Or more appropriately put, how does the Torah categorize science? So there's the Ramah says in Hilchos Talmud Torah that you have to learn Torah the whole day and night, can't stop, ever, never. And the Ramah says that you're allowed to learn Sfarim Chitzoniyim, you're allowed to learn other books. Just you can't do bekfiyus. Occasionally you can learn other stuff. And the Ramah says, this is what's called Pardes, that the Matayal B'Pardes, they used to take a walk in the garden. It's metaphorical. It means they used to venture out. So the Vilna Gaon says on that he's coming from the Rambam. The Rambam already touched different things in the Gemara, Ma'aseh Bereishis and Pardes, which we usually translate to mean esoteric. The Rambam says it refers to nature. And the Gaon finishes that neither the Ramon nor the Rambam know what Pardes is. In other words, the Gaon understands that Pardes refers to Kabbalah, Sisri Torah. However, the Rambam seem to be going that Pardes means nature, you know, biology book, 10th grade, with that section ripped out, whatever. Anyway, so the Ran and the Drush is already, and Rabbi Chanan also goes to Zich Mahalach. They explain that there's two types of Pardes. There's a lower Pardes and an upper Pardes. There's two types of study. There's a lower study and there's an upper study. And the truth is there's two types of worlds. There's a lower world, the physical world that we experience, and there's a metaphysical world, the spiritual world. This spiritual world is something that's beyond their perception. It's not something we could, it's not tangible. However, it's there, and it's a dual reality. But the truth is it's more than a dual reality. The truth is that our reality is only reflective of that deeper and greater reality. And there's a bit different ways to refer to that world. The Rambam has Lashon and Olam, is it Tzuris? Anyways, that world, that spiritual entity, is the true projector that is showing the film upon what our life is, the film, and the true projector where everything is coming from is that deeper world. The Gemara refers to this world. The Gemara says that the Beis HaMikdash HaMata is Mechuvan connected to the Beis HaMikdash HaMaila. It means that there's an upper and a lower. The Medrash says that every grass has an angel hitting it and saying, grow. Every physical, earthly component has a spiritual counterpart. And thereby, it's understandable that if someone delves into the spiritual matter, the metaphysical universe, the metaphysical world, then the physical world follows necessarily. So, LaMashal Moshe Rabbeinu, that knew Kol Torah Kula, so he knew everything about the world and about the natural order as well, but not through experimentation. And not through observation. He knew it. He knew what had to be there. He didn't just know what was there. He knew a lot more than what was there. The Torah, this explains a lot of the statements that Chazal make. Chazal makes statements that...
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
The Medrash says that Hashem had to show him the animals in Parsha Shmini, but if he knew the whole natures, then why did he know what they were?
I don't know. So the Medrash, so the Gemara says that you're not going to find the fin and scale. You're not going to find this fish that has scales without a fin. The Gemara makes different predictions about animals that you're going to find, and it's simply not possible that the Chachamim, and if we ascribe to the Chachamim at least that they weren't falsifiers, at least that, then it's not possible that they could have known because they didn't observe all the animals. Then they've been to Australia. So it's obvious that they had access to a higher level of information. That is what the Rambam refers to as Pardes. That's why you can't learn Pardes in public. That's why Abar Nichesu LePardes, and some people never made it out. Not because it's biology. The reason I never made it out is because it's referring to the esoteric learning. Pardes has two meanings. The Amor, like Abar Nichesu LePardes, is referring to Pardes. He means, you know, the general secular knowledge. But there's a much deeper and higher Pardes. So, bearing that in mind, all statements of Chazal should be taken with the utmost severity and sincerity. It's very tempting to say that just like we have information, no one here probably, except for that in 8th and 9th grade, we had a lab. Chaim Bloom got a lab, and there's mamish, that sonnet. We used to shut the lights and open all the hoses and put the fires on and take frogs and throw it against the wall. Most of us, mamish, we didn't learn a thing in the lab. So any of us that have any bit of scientific knowledge, it comes because rabbis also. It comes from doctors and scientists and people in the field that tell us information, that do experimentation. It's very tempting to think that the Chachamim had the same method. And we'll see that there might be a grain of truth to a certain extent. But it's tempting to say that we know just like they know. So if our scientists are better quality than their scientists, so then our information is better than theirs, so then we win. And the halachas and everything has to change based on our information. But the truth is, it's very important to remember that they had a much higher access. They knew more information from a much higher source, higher from their scientists and even higher from our scientists. That being said, let's take one case in point and examine and see if we could resolve some of the issues. I'm sure everyone heard of an idea called spontaneous generation. Spontaneous generation is the belief, which was held by mankind for many thousands of years, that life forms could come from organic material. You know, dirt, inorganic, whatever. It could come from plain dirt, it could come from rocks, it could come from sweat, different things. Just rotting meat could, a storehouse of grain could form, or a mouse could form. Modern science has rejected this, although the truth is, it's always hard to prove a negative, right? Go prove that you can't travel through time. So how are you going to prove that maybe back in the day, their sweat was able to make, But rationally, we conclude that spontaneous generation is dead. If that's the case, so we have interesting Gemara on Shabbos. The Gemara on Shabbos says that that's also the kill on Shabbos. Shechita is one of the Isma Malachas. However, as all Malachas on Shabbos, it's learned out of the Mishkan. Now the Mishkan, the Shechita, was done to Elim, rams. And why they kill Elim? Because they need the skin. So the Gemara says, just like rams have specific qualities in that they reproduce through cohabitation, procreation, male, female, perivirivia, however you want to exactly translate it. The point is, they get married and have kids. So too, all animals that have the same type of, that also reproduce like that. Masha'in ken kinim, and we'll soon see what kinim means. Kinim, they don't do perivirivia, they don't reproduce. Therefore, you're allowed to kill kinim on Shabbos. And the Gemara makes a distinction. That kinim is not doma to rams, because rams reproduce and kinim don't. Kinim don't come from, kinim are spontaneously generated. Mashen kein parush, which is another type of animal, which is very similar to a kinim. Parush, that comes from parents, it is really alive, and if you kill it, you chayv misa. So two small animals, both very similar, this is totally mutter, kill it all you want, and this is chayv misa. So the question arises, if we don't believe in spontaneous generation, and we do believe in the Gemara, so what gives? Are we wrong? The Gemara is wrong, Chas v'Shalom. What are we talking about? So, this question wasn't asked first, Tavshinayin Dalet. Parshas Chayasar. This question starts with from what I saw, the earlier source was the Pachiv Yitzchak. Pachiv Yitzchak, Rabbi Yitzchak Lampertoni, he asked this question. That according to modern knowledge today, everything comes from eggs. If everything comes from eggs, you should not be allowed to kill. So he asked his Rebbe, and his Rebbe said, "We don't throw away halachas of Gemara because of modern scientific research." And there was some letters back and forth, and he said he accepted his Rebbe's opinion with a heavy heart. He said, "You know, personally, I thought maybe not, but you're my Rebbe, and I'm a Vatal Das, and he paskins la halacha, you're allowed to kill kinim, even though I don't understand." That's what he says. The more modern attempts to explain this, the first one from the more recent writers, is brought in the Michtam Melio, who's quoted extensively, everyone quotes the Michtam Melio, that they asked Rav Dessler this question. And Rav Dessler said the same thing, that the Chazal have a statement, they have a Masorah, and we don't throw away Chazal because of modern research. However, in this case, anyways, I think I have a very simple explanation. And the explanation that he gives is an explanation also found in the Reb Chaim Kanievsky Sefer Derech Amuna, and people say Shlomo Zalman Erbach also goes with it. The explanation is the follows. There's a big question. How do you make cheese from milk? How do you do that? Bacteria. How do you make wine? How do you make vinegar from wine? How do you do that? Bacteria. Bacteria is bugs. How do you let it eat bacteria? How do you let it walk outside on the street? You're ingesting bacteria. How do you let it live in Florida? right? Everything is moist over here and wet. Your mom's living in a, you're living in lettuce land. It's like eating non-check lettuce. So why are you laughing? The answer is, this question was posed to big rabbis, amongst them the Aruch HaShulchan, the Chacham Sadim, and they all said that the sub-visual world doesn't count. Hashem gave Torah to us as people who have two eyes and ears and nose and mouth, without special equipment, and whatever he gave to us, that's how we have to work with, and if we can't perceive it, then it's not aser. That's what they say. So, Reb Chaim Kanievsky says, hey, if that's the case, the kinim are so small that we can't notice the eggs. So if we don't notice the eggs of kinim, so the kinim eggs are said halachically not to exist. If they don't exist halachically, so when they hatch, and the kinim, whatever kinim means, when the kinim come out, they're starting from fresh. So their history is erased. It's like Gershon's guy cutting chanela dummy. Once the eggs we can't see, the eggs don't exist. So if the eggs don't exist, when they become alive, that's called spontaneous generation with a halachic twist. Therefore, you're allowed to kill them. So I was very happy you asked this, because I wanted to throw this in, but I thought it would be veering off the side. But now I could say an answer. So that explains why Henry did it. So the answer is that the Rebbe Meiselman, who a lot of what I'm saying is called from, if not every last thing, Rebbe Meiselman brings the Chasam Sofer and Lida Dafir Ches, as well as Tess Yom Tov. And this idea I also saw somewhere, maybe I'll think of it. That the Rishonim are different than the Chazal. The Rishonim, even the Chazal, I'm going to have to see exactly what this means, but the Rishonim did not have access to this higher world. They did not have the wisdom of Shlomo HaMelech, and they did not have the wisdom of Moshe Rabbeinu, and they were not able to discern all the reality through this Olam. So when the Rishonim saw Gemara, and they read the Gemara, and they explained the Gemara, very often in the explanation of the Gemara, just like the story with Rashi, and you saw a Gentile woman going by with the Chashim Mishpah, that whole story. So.
Let's start.
I don't have time. I'll speak to someone else. So too, the Rishonim also they used modern knowledge that they had at the time to explain halachas that they saw. There is, however, and you have to say this, and it's obvious from countless places, that there is a hashkocha over the Mesorah, and the Rebbeinu Shloim guided his children and the Rishonim to get the right conclusions, even if sometimes the medical knowledge they were dealing with was faulty. But again, there's a very clear distinction between Chazal and the Rishonim, that when the Chazal give a reason for halacha, it's very possible to say that the reason that they gave was based on their knowledge firsthand, at the time, and we are not restricted, lav dafka, we're restricted to that reason. This is the base in the Chasam Sofer and Dafir Chasam Beis Nida and Tez Yom Tov in Klein. Anyways, so that's the pshat. Therefore, since the kinim eggs you can't see the kinim, so they don't exist. When they come into existence, that's the first time. The problem is, we said kinim and prushim. Kinim, you're allowed to kill, they're too small. Prushim, you're not allowed to kill. Well, what does kinim mean? What does prushim mean? The classical simple translation of kinim is lice. And the simple translation of prushim is fleas. Lice have eggs. We all know what lice eggs are. They're called nits. Nits are about an eighth of an inch or a tenth of an inch. Very noticeable, especially if you're looking carefully. Totally noticeable to the naked eye. To the naked eye.
Noticeable.
Noticeable, very noticeable.
You check for
nits. You find nits. They're white. You can totally see nits. Mashenkin fleas are just opposite. Fleas are a 50th of an inch, the eggs, and they're not noticeable to the naked eye. So it's mamish punk fakert. Kinim, that means lice, we're saying they're too small to see, therefore it's spontaneous generation, therefore you're allowed to kill them. Perushim, which means fleas, which dear you pack a cannot see, we're saying no, that you're not allowed to touch. So it's a problem. So the answer is, partly, that it's geshmak, because Rabbeinu Chananel and the Abuses of Merolin switch it around, and they learn that lice is what you're allowed to kill. Lice is what you're not allowed to kill, rather. Lice is referring to parushim, that you're not allowed to kill, because they're attacking big, it's gevalt. And kinim are that you're allowed to kill are fleas, attacking too small. The problem is that, you know, that's nice, but that's not the most Rishonim don't go with that, and the Halach and Shulchan Aruch down to the Mishnah Berurah doesn't go with that, and all the person don't go with that. So if you want to still explain why Jews have been killing lice for thousands of years, this is not going to suffice. So, some want to say, let's take the visual, sub-visual approach even a step further. Let's say like this. Let's say that until now we were saying that if you can't see something, it doesn't exist. Let's take it a step further. Let's say that if you can't see where something came from, then you don't, then the source is non-existent. In other words, you have two things, A and B. They're both existent. They're both obvious. They're both, you can see them. But you cannot see, and it's impossible to perceive, and it has never been perceived historically, that A came from B. So it's not the noun, the object that cannot be seen. It's the verb. It's this coming from this that cannot be seen. So since the source cannot be perceived, therefore we could say that it doesn't have a parent in halacha, because it's, the parent is not a parent. Therefore, everyone's still getting nervous. We're gonna get there. So therefore, that would explain why, even though you have lice, and lice have nits, and you could see lice, and you could see nits, it's still geschmack why the Gemara says you're allowed to kill them, because you cannot see that one comes from the other.
By the person.
Oh, so the kasha is, oy bazoi, it's punktfaker, it's even worse. Because fleas. because fleas are even smaller. So if you're gonna say the shtickle Torah and take sub-visual a step further, so you got for sure have to take it a step back and say the fleas that can't be seen, for sure. So this is a wonderful question, and let's remember that this question posed a problem to people who believe in spontaneous generation as the Rishonim Moses did, because they also didn't see a difference. Anyways, so there's a wonderful mahalach from the Rambam, as explained by the Ran, and that is the following. The Ran explains that the Rambam paskins that lice are allowed to be killed, but not only lice, even maggots and other such vermin that come from rotting, decaying fecal material. The Ran says, the Ran explains the Rambam. What's the difference? Lice, you're allowed to kill. Fleas, not. But maggots, yeah. And they're like, well, what's going on? Like, well, you want a killing spree. You have to decide. And that makes some sort of a list. So the Ran explains like this, that fleas come from the ground. They come from the earth. Fleas come from the ground. They come from the earth. Earth is a life-giving material. Adam came from the earth. Memela, so even though they don't have parents, they spontaneously generated, in the mind of the Ran, let's say, they believed that back then, spontaneously generated, but they came from a life source, Mother Earth. However, lice, that also spontaneously generated, but they didn't come from a life source, they came from decaying fecal matter. I don't know where lice come from, they come from sweat. So, in our terms, this means like this. Both fleas and both lice and maggots, they're all too small to perceive. Whether they're too small to perceive the egg, or whether it's too small to perceive the connection, they're halachically considered when they're born as if they just came into being today. But that's where the similarities end. Where it came to be born, in other words, where it appeared, where it hatched, it depends, gevalt. If it hatched from the ground, so we say, it doesn't have parents, but it's from a life-giving source, so it has an intrinsic life, which is as if it has parents. That's what the Rambam says. Masha'inkein, lice, they also, you couldn't see them. So when they hatched, it's like they came into being. But where'd they come from? They thrive in sweat and decaying and maggots also. Therefore, halachically, lice are better off in terms of killing them because they have less of a life to them. And Taka, flipping Rabbi Ribiad's book, he says it very nicely. He says it's higher forms of life and lower forms of life. And that's Pshat the Rambam, and that's why you're allowed to kill maggots and lice, and you're not allowed to kill fleas, because fleas come from the earth. There's the problem is Rabbeinu Tam. Also, Rabbeinu Tam has the same order, but it doesn't go with the Ran, so there's still going to be a Rishon that's a stickle stock. You have to work it out. I want to tell you what a Mahalach I heard from Rabbi Saul Belsky many years ago, and I confirmed it with a Chosh Talmud of his. And, oh, no, whatever. Talmud of Rajman. Which one? I confirmed it, I think. He says like this. He says, he drops the whole sub-visual. He says a better pshat. I mean, I didn't mean that. Taka didn't mean that. I meant he says a very interesting different pshat. He doesn't use a sub-visual mouth. He says that all animals in the world, it's a very interesting point, come from the parents directly. That means that when a baby is born, I don't care what creature, the baby is 100% from its parents. Some babies live in a womb and they piecemeal, the parent gives it nutrients and builds it up, piece by piece. Some babies are in an egg, and they're placed down on the ground, and the parent gives everything at once, and then it takes time and it develops by itself. But either way, 100% of the child is from the parent. Dr. Abelsky, lice are essentially different, because lice are from the only things in the world that the egg itself is a parasite. It's not just the louse that's a parasite. the egg clings to your hair. Because the egg, now this, from I did research on this, and I did not see explicitly that that scientists have said that the eggs eat. I did not see this explicitly. But I also didn't see not, and I heard from Mary Belsky. And it also makes a lot of sense because the eggs cling on to the hair with a special saliva. And what he says is that the lice, the nits, when they're released from the louse for the first time, they do not have enough material to form another louse. They cannot be built up right now. They can't hatch. There's not enough there. It's like a chicken laying an egg without a yolk. What happens is they have to go ahead and find the nutrients and find the materials to build themselves up to have enough material to become a louse. Therefore, they're not considered to have reproduced because they don't fully come from the parents. They come from the environment. Since they don't come from the parents, they're not doyme to rams. And the halacha is by rams, therefore anything that's doyme to rams is chayv, and if you're not doyme to rams, it's pater. These are several of the mahalchim to answer, and my point in going through
things that are born can't reproduce on the spot. They also have to
move all there,
right? The tantra's all there. So there's a lot of different gemaras and a lot of different explanations are needed, but my point here is only to show that very often when the explanation is not apparent, it's there beneath the surface, you have to search for it, and a man will not go wrong by believing every word in Chazal. There is another Gemara, which is a little bit more difficult, and I'm bringing this out specifically to bring out a very subtle point, which I hope goes over well. The Gemara talks about an earth mouse. The Mishnah talks about what's the halachic status of an earth mouse. You have a mouse that's partly made out of the earth and partly made out of flesh. And after a few days, it becomes totally flesh. So it begins from the earth and turns, and at one point it's half and half, and then the next day already it's fully flesh. So the Gemara has a halachic discussion. If you touch it, are you tamei? If you touch the earth part, if you touch the flesh part. The problem is that from our experience, there's no such thing. Nor does our rational mind allow us to imagine that there ever was such a thing. However, again, back to the proving the negatives, it's very difficult to go out and prove a negative. And this earth mouse was attested to by Pliny the Elder, I think by Aristotle also. A lot of non-Jews accepted this also. Maybe they had their own independent sources, whatever it is. So the Shaila is, how do we square that with the reality that we're aware of? So Rabbi Meiselman, he makes a very, very delicate point. He says like this. He says, it's true what we said before, that Chazal had access to a higher Masera. They had access to a deeper cosmic, metaphysical, supernatural world that gave them all information they needed about our physical world. However, just as we find Chazal had questions in Halacha, where they said Teiku, they had no answer. So there's no reason to assume that they were more proficient in this metaphysical world than they were in the world of Halacha. If in the world of Halacha there could be gaps in the knowledge, the Gemara says after Moshe Rabbeinu died, Halachas were forgotten and then they were remembered. If you could have gaps in your knowledge, and the Rambam says this basically, the Ramah says this explicitly to the Halachas of astrology, of Kiddush HaChadosh, that Chachmas all knew and it was forgotten. That's why we need Chachmas to learn astrology. So Zogt Rabbi Meiselman, just because there is a metaphysical world out there, and just because Chazal saw into that world, and just because many of their statements are based on that, and the definitive statements are certainly based on that, it doesn't follow that everything that Chazal said has to come from there. It's possible Chazal also were human beings, and they also had a perception of the world. When you have a definitive statement in Chazal, especially one that's Nagei Halacha, so Chazal wouldn't have made that statement if they hadn't seen in the upper world as well. However, if all the cases of the earth mouse, there's a few cases of what's mentioned. One case is where the Gemara is discussing the Hilchos Tumah V'Tahara. Is it Tahor? Is it Tameh? So it's very plausible that people outside in the academic world said this existed. So the Chazal were discussing what's the Halacha. Well, before anyone that learns knows that often when you want to bring out a point, so you go to an extreme bizarre case because you're trying to bring out a subtle nakuda, so you want to take it to the extreme to see how far your friend's argument or your argument's going to go. So it's entirely possible that the Chazal, not having independently verified whether this exists through their knowledge of Chachmas HaPardes, Rather, they were just discussing what halacha would be according to your words. And we find a case where a heretic said, how do you know the bitchis ha-meisim? I said, go outside, look, you see an earth mouse? Well, if that could transfer from earth to thing. So we always find that the chacham answered the heretic in their own words. And afterwards they said, yeah, I don't believe it, but according to him. So again, just because something that's in between the pages, the folios of Talmud Bavli, you have to know the context of the idea, and you have to know lahalach lamaisa. So each case really deserves an individual diagnosis.
Long story short, was there such a thing as an earth mouse or not?
The long story short is that it's very possible there wasn't, and that doesn't pose a challenge to us because no one ever said there was.
And the fact that Ravina sometimes argues on the Haba from four generations shows that he was completely wrong. Doesn't
necessarily mean that
Sarabu,
saying,
didn't have this ability to look up
to Mishra Shemayim and see this way of hurting places, didn't understand this Mishnah. Why would Rabbi be able to make a mistake in a Mishnah and not make a mistake in understanding the way the world exists? See me after class.
Anyways,
so the Shai did this. How old is the world? Now this is not Chazal. This is already Tarshav Iksav. The Torah says explicitly that the world is, I mean, the Torah doesn't say these words, but based on the numbers and ideas and stories written in the Tanakh and codified by the Torah Shabbat Peh, the world is 5,700, whatever. The problem is that the rest of the world, I mean, today, the world says, no, the world is billions of years old. And there are tons and tons of proof. So after we discussed how Choshek Chazal is and how much they know, especially the Torah itself, how much it knows, so... And also, like I was talking to my friend last night, I made a very good point that at the end of the day, the burden of proof is on the people, is on the Machadish. For thousands of years, no one thought the world was billions of years old. Yes, the Greeks thought the world was eternal. But everyone agreed that if there was a star period, it was 5,000, whatever. That's as long as recorded history goes. People today want to come in the past century, want to say it's billions of years old, they have to prove it. Now, I'll tell you the truth. We'll discuss all the proofs in a moment, but the reason why they say it is because evolution needs it. If you can believe in evolution, which is beyond the scope of this lecture, if you can believe evolution, then you need a lot of time. Therefore, they want the world to be billions old. The proof came after. That's the honest truth. You heard it here first. Anyways, so let's go through some of the proofs. Number one, how did the solar system spread so far out, right? You have a huge solar system, billions and billions of light years and everything, so how did it get so far out, right? Everything started from the Big Bang, so how did it get there, right? That's stupid because it was created like that. It wasn't a Big Bang. Number two, how did starlight reach our Earth? It's so millions of light years away. How did it reach our Earth? Answer: Hashem created the world with starlight. Number three, how did ice ages come and go? How could the world get so hot and so cold in a short amount of time? The answer is no ice ages. How did the oceans get so salty? The oceans today are constantly getting salt through rivers. The rivers bring sediments and earth and salt into the ocean, and the oceans get salty. The question is. Huh? The earth, the water brings river sediments and earth deposits and salt into the ocean, and the ocean gets salty. So the question is, you know how long it would take for the ocean to get salty at this rate? So the answer is, Hashem made salty oceans. Okay, how did the Grand Canyon form? You know how long it would take? Yes, a second, gracious. Next one, evolution. Evolution couldn't have happened so quickly. Now, these are real things that researchers, by the way. These are real arguments that people at serious websites postulate. Evolution couldn't have happened quickly, right? It needs a lot of time. Again, fine. So now let's go to the first semi-proof, something called the geological rock column. Now, if you go into any classroom across America or the world, you'll see the geological rock column, very simple. You have rocks, and there's a lower, the Cambrian level, that's the lowest rock. And that was billions of years ago. And in the Cambrian level, you find fossils that are so old. And then there's a next level of rock above that, you know, nice and calm, like uniform on top. And then those are fossils of higher, what's the word? Higher sophistication, which came later, and so on and so forth. And you have miles and miles of earth. And layers, and in each one, the earth is really old, and the fossils in it are old, and the fossils have to step up. There's one problem. The problem is that this exists in so many different places above ground in classrooms. Where it doesn't exist is below ground. The impression that you would have by reading this stuff is that if you were to dig right here beneath here at 100 feet, 100 miles, you would see different uniform levels of dirt and rocks and earth and fossils, and they go higher and higher. And there's nothing that could be further from the truth. There's absolutely nothing. The Cambrian age, which is called the oldest age of the earth, which is the first age of the earth was spread, the floor of the earth at that time with the globe was surrounded by Cambrian rock, there is no single identifying Cambrian factor. In other words, it's not limestone, it's not sandstone, it's not coal. There's nothing that makes something Cambrian. So what makes it Cambrian? Oh, maybe, I know. It's the fact that it's underneath. No, it's not that either. Because it's Cambrian up and down all over the place. So what makes it Cambrian? Because they find fossils in this and these particular places of the earth. Again, all sorts of material, limestone, sandstone, everything. But they find fossils there that are old. So they find fossils that are old. They know that this piece of earth is old. How do they know the fossils are old? Because they're primitive. They're small plants, they're jellyfish. I'm saying these are primitive stuff. Even though most of them still survive today, that's Akasha. That's not Akasha evolution. Okay. From Akasha Statmanish. But the point is that it's a circular reasoning where what they do is they take a fossil, they identify the fossil as old, then they identify the place where the fossil was found as old because it was old fossils, and then everything else that comes from that area of the ground is proven to be old because it comes from old ground. And the problem is that even if you would go with this hypothesis, there's all different sorts of fossils of all different sorts of complexity levels in the same level. Oh, but they have. They found human fossils together with every other fossils, including dinosaurs. They found everything together. What they do is, you're never going to find it together. You're right. Because what they do is like this. Okay, this is Cambrian. Cambrian took that back. Cambrian goes in waves. And they, like this, they avoid any new fossil. And they say the state park in Montana moved over a few hundred miles. But you could have never noticed it if not for the age of the fossils. There's no upheaval on the ground around it. So it's a pillar plane. It's mamish a ganze binyan that's built on hevel verit and mamish lights and trees. That's what it's built on. Once you find these rocks, they determine that the rocks are old. Okay, we're going to talk about right now the determining date, but I can't get into it. The point is that it's total bogus, and there is no level, and it's not uniform, and there's no place on earth that has like that. The only thing is, once they take a fossil and they find it in the earth and say this earth is Cambrian, in the classrooms, when they construct the models, they put Cambrian at the bottom because it's the oldest. And the next thing is the next, and the next thing is the next. And then when they show you at the museums, they put the fossils on each level where they find it. But most of the time it's Stussim. Now, let's say they'll find a place that has only, sea creatures or like low, fish and like jellyfish and plants. I say, look, there were no animals yet. Well, when's the last time you saw a tiger hanging out with a sea fish and a jellyfish and a plant? Animals do. Just because you found a stretch of a few miles where there's certain type of fossils and not other fossils, that indicates nothing. If you would take that mile and go across the entire globe, now we're talking. But they don't do that. They take isolated patches here and there, and they construct a whole level. And Bechlau, even if you want to say that there's a lot of more plants down underneath, it's because you could very, very possibly by the marble, a lot of animals ran to the higher ground. But it's not even so compelling that you have to come up with these explanations. So I don't want to spend more time on this now, but look it up yourself. I didn't believe this. I researched it. I'm telling you, it's really true. The geological, the geological maps and rock columns are based on circular reasoning. They're based on the age of the fossils, which are based in turn on the age of the rocks. I'm telling you, I researched it. Next.
Carbon dating.
Thank you. What is carbon dating? Everyone heard of carbon dating? And they trust that the guys in the white coats are they know what to talk about. In my days, the guy with the white coats came to take away the loonies. Apparently, the insane run the asylum now, because if you think, carbon dating is like this. The process of carbon dating is like this. Carbon is a compound, and when the sun strikes, the cosmic rays from the sun strike the atmosphere, so it mixes it releases neutrons. And these neutrons that it releases mixes with nitrogen in the air. You can leave out the neutrons. The point is that the cosmic rays mix with nitrogen. The mixture of cosmic rays and nitrogen breaks the nitrogen, and the nitrogen turns into something else. That something else is carbon. But it's not regular carbon. It's called carbon-14. The way that carbon-14 is created, is formed, is through the mixture of cosmic rays and nitrogen. Now, carbon 14 and carbon together are the entire world, and all plants and animals absorb carbon. Plants mostly, and animals through eating plants, and people through eating carbon, people through eating animals. Now, because one thing you have to know about carbon 14, it's not regular carbon, it's carbon, but it's a radioactive isotope. A radioactive isotope. Radioactive isotope means, essentially, that it's a form of carbon which is not stable. Meaning some atoms are stable. It has beta neutrons, electrons, it has a good order. It can sit, it has flush. It can sit for a long time. Then you have other atoms that are all over the place. They're unstable. These are atoms that you want to make nuclear stuff with because it's easier to slice them if they're unstable. Unstable means that they're not disputing with what they are. Right? They have image issues. And essentially, they keep changing. We say keep changing, it takes a long time for them to change. But there's things that will change over time. So carbon, regular carbon, is a stable compound. An isotope, which means a mixture of carbon-14 is a radioactive isotope. Radioactive means it's safe, it's unstable, and therefore it leaks and changes. It changes, it leaks its essence, and it changes into something else. What does it change into, carbon-14? It changes into, back to nitrogen, and it disappears. So we have cosmic rays, nitrogen, carbon-14, which eventually turns back to nitrogen. So now, the theory is like this. If you take any sample of air in the world right now, it'll have equal levels of carbon and carbon-14. Carbon is the air, and carbon-14 comes to the sun. And even though carbon-14 is always disappearing and turning back into nitrogen, but more is always coming in, so therefore it's always going to be equal. Once you have an entity, it could be a plant, it could be a cockroach, whatever it is, once you have an entity that dies, so it stops breathing, it stops interacting with the world, and it stops taking in carbon-14. The carbon-14 inside of it is all that it will ever get, and the carbon inside of it is all that we'll ever get. From now on, it is how it is. So the carbon inside of it, so let's say we find a bone from a long time ago. So the carbon inside the bone was there at the time of death. Never left, no more is coming in. However, the carbon-14, since the moment of death, begins to decrease, and turn back into nitrogen. So if we know, let's say it takes a certain amount of time for this carbon to go back to nitrogen and to disappear. So if you go and you see a bone, and the ratio of carbon to carbon-14 is 50% to 100%, so I know that the amount of time that it takes for half of carbon-14 to turn into nitrogen is the amount of time that this thing was dead for. That's the theory of carbon-14. Now, carbon-14, as you know, things die and change over in half-lives. So carbon-14, half of it disappears and becomes nitrogen in 5,300 years. Every 5,300 years, half is going to be gone, replaced by nitrogen. So, if you're going to go out and you're going to find a bone from a long time ago, or a fossil from a long time ago, and you're going to date it. By the way, you can only date it by burning it up. So, if you ever have an intact fossil, they couldn't have dated it. So, you burn it up, and you date it.
Why is the burning dated?
Because you can measure the smoke, the carbon in the air. Don't ask me now. I did that part. Anyway. So what do? You take the carbon in the air and you measure it. If, let's say, half the carbon-14 is there in proportion to the carbon, so you know that this bone is 5,300 years old. And take it a step further, if only a quarter is there, so it's 11,000. And this goes back to 50,000 years. Beyond that, it's not accurate. And even this is, at the end of the day, how much do we really know about this stuff? But let's give them that. Let's give them that they could try to prove that the world is 50,000 years old. First of all, 50,000 is not 50 billion. It's two zeros and numbers. Again, there's no proof it's billion. The billion is only because of evolution. That's the only reason why they say billion. Now, what's the answer? Why is it that there's proof, seemingly, that the world is over 5,000 years? The answer is very simple. What causes carbon? What causes carbon-14? Anyone following?
The sun.
The sun striking the Earth's atmosphere. When did the sun start striking the Earth's atmosphere? 5,700 Bracius. So, at the moment of Bracius, how much carbon-14 was there in the world?
Zero.
So the theorists, they look at a fossil and they say, there's come out no carbon-14 here. That means that it died 50,000 years ago. And it all disappeared, and the carbon-14 is gone. But we say, no, It's not because it disappeared, it's because it never was there. How long does it take? Today, the carbon levels are equal. Today, they're equal. But how long did it take to build up? That's not known. One scientist put their number at 5,000 years. It'll take 5,000 years to build up a stable level of carbon to carbon. So the dating methods are based on the own assumptions that the world is millions of years old and the carbon has always been here. And at the time of death, 5,000 years ago, the carbon levels were equal. So then, yes, why is there so much less carbon?
I understand. There are cockroaches back, cockroaches
had less carbon-14. That's exactly what Urban Miller says. He says their potatoes had less carbon-14, and therefore their potato eaters had less carbon-14. Therefore, the fossils of the potato eaters had less carbon-14. There's no question about it. Carbon-14, they themselves admit it only comes from cosmic rays. So if it only comes from cosmic rays only started aberrations. If it only started aberrations, the world started out with zero. So if I see something that has a little bit of carbon-14, I know only one thing, that it's from the beginning of the world. That's it.
Why would Hashem make the water cool and not the carbon 50-50? Why would he pick one, not the other?
I don't know.
Your answer is only based because it's answering, it's not true. You have a reason to say the water would be sold to you.
I don't know, if you ever went to Chafetz Chaim, you know there's a concept of offense and defense. So I'm on defense right now. I could say it's not mukhach. You can't say it's mukhach. Because I'll tell you, as they themselves say, the only source of carbon-14 in the world is from the cosmic rays. They think maybe they're nuclear also, but even nuclear is only recent and not nearly on the same scale. It's only nuclear rays that could do this. So I'm going by what they said. There's no proof. You have to know a lot of these things only to answer them. To us, you know, the whole thing is a little bit fishy, you know what I'm saying? First try to figure out, you know, what that bump on your foot is. Like, you know, don't try to, my billions of years ago was very tricky. Anyways, it looks like we're running out of time, so I'll just share a very interesting mahalach that I heard once, that I can see it's brought here from Rabbi Arya Kaplan. He says, he brings a very interesting sefer like this. The Sefer HaTmuna, which is an ancient Kabbalistic book. Maybe close the lights. And this ancient Kabbalistic book writes that the world that we know is 6,000 years, 7,000 years, is only part of a greater cycle. There's a Shemitah cycle of the world. And every 7,000 years is a new world. And then the Yovel of the world would be 50,000 years. And so the 7,000 years of the world that the Ag Gemara talks about means our cycle.
But there are,
the Sefer Tmuna is in the Sefer Tmuna.
Yeah,
the Sefer Tmuna. I'm proud of it. He brings down the words at the bottom. He brings down the quote and the place and the Hebrew letters. Anyways,
Rabbi Yitzchok of Akron
had a Sefer, which is not published. The Sefer is called Eitz Chaim. It's in manuscript form. And Rabbi Kaplan, who
knew all that the ancient Sfarim, he came across where it says in this written echo that the 7,000 years that we're discussing, that there's seven cycles of 7,000 years, they're not regular 7,000 years. The seven cycles are 7,000 years. Each year is a year of Hashem. It's Hashem's years. The year of Hashem is Elf Shana. So it comes out that instead of the whole cycle, the grand cycle being 42,000 years, which would be 7,000 times 7, it's each year is 365,000, whatever, years. So 365,000, whatever, times 42,000 is roughly 15 billion.
Again, seven Shemitah cycles. And each cycle is made up of years, that each year is 365,000. So if you have 42,000 of such years, you have 15 billion, which is around what the modern scientists say today.
Elef Shana, Kenes
Magyaver. I don't know. That's a good question. I'm with you on this. I agree with you 100%. And that's going to be the. We're going to knock it away, don't worry. Anyway, so.
That's for next week.
No, right now, in a minute. So. where is that off to?
Ritzin Ma'akov
is the Talmud of the Ramban. Talmud of the Ramban. And he wrote a Sefer Pirush in the Ramban on the Chumash. And he lived with the Ramban when the Ramban went to Akko at the end of his life. Anyway, so So he says that it means, so the basically Akko says that each year means is correspond, it means 300, each year means 1,000 years. So Zokter of Kaplan, that there's a sefer called the Livnes HaSapir. And the Livnes HaSapir, he says that we're in the seventh cycle of the simple reading of the sefer Tmuna tells us that we're in the second cycle. The Livnes HaSapir says that we're in the seventh cycle. And the captain says, Livnes HaSapir is the most authoritative voice on the Sefer Tmura. So now, the problem is like this. Okay, these aren't my problems, I'm quoting heavily. The problem is like this. That, first of all, the Livnes HaSapir doesn't even mention the Sefer Tmura by name. He brings it from a different source entirely. Anyways, the problem is like this. First of all, in order to say this, you need to put together two shittas that never came together. You need to say that we're, first of all, in the seventh, not the second. Second of all, you have to say that each year means 1,000 years.
What's the issue you're trying to solve?
How old the world is.
What's the issue?
He says that the world is 15 billion years, it stems in the scientific dates. So he's saying it's not going to work. First of all, the Gedolei Mekubalei, the Ari and the Ramak reject the whole Sefer HaTmura's premise that the world is cycles. That's first of all. However, the Goyin and the Leshem go with it. So, again, the Sefer HaTmura doesn't is much more in the second year. It's only Livnes HaSapir that says we're in the seventh year, and it's only Ritz Chibur Akko that says it's 1,000 years per year. So you're putting together a totally new opinion that never happened. In addition, the world, the Ramak says, Avada, the world's Yesh Mayayim. The Gemara already, the Medrash in Kehelas already says that Hashem built worlds and destroyed it. Zokter Ramak, about Vada, this world is created Yesh Mayayim. What Hashem did before is Hashem's business. When we came onto the scene, our world is Yesh Mayayim. The Teres Yisrael also tries to use this idea to explain dinosaur bones, which is a very strange thing, because why does he need to explain dinosaur bones? What's wrong with dinosaur bones? Dinosaur bones are fine. There's one dinosaur, who cares? But for some reason, he's troubled by dinosaurs, so he says, you know what it is? It's because it's from the previous worlds, which is a Pella, because this world was created Yesh Mayayin. There's no question about that. So, even if the Livnes HaSapir could go through Mitzvah Akko and say, well, the seventh year, it's 5,000 years, then it's 15 billion, that was all gone. So, you can't prove it from the rocks. And second of all, like Rabbi Saperstein saying, Livnes HaSapir, shame. I've been saying that it's all, if you look at it closely, it's esoteric stuff. It's referring to Kabbalah, it's referring to the spheres, and it's not something that can be used physically for our world. Questions and answers by Chalant.